This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Ashton Mara. Lawmakers returned to Charleston during the weekend for their August interim meetings. Like most interims, these meetings focus on a variety of topics. But in the first set since June's historic flooding, Sunday's meetings focused largely on the state's reaction to high waters that caused millions of dollars worth of damage in 12 counties. Two legislative interim committees received updates Sunday on the state of West Virginia's recovery since June's flooding. Infrastructure came first, where Department of Transportation Secretary Paul Maddox told lawmakers the state's highways, roads, and bridges suffered more than $55 million in damage. That damage was largely focused in three counties, Clay, Kanawha, and Greenbrier. And Maddox says significant progress has been made in repairs in those areas.
This storm basically impacted two of our districts, District 9, which is in Lewisburg, and District 1 here in Charleston. Talked to our district manager on Friday in Lewisburg, and they're at about 80% complete as far as repairing flood-damaged roads over in District 9. District 1 is probably at about 40% complete as far as getting the roads back to where they were prior to the flood.
Maddox estimates that flood-affected routes in the Greenbrier County area will be back to normal within 4 to 6 weeks. In the Kanawha and Clay County areas, Maddox says it will take slightly longer because of the extent of the damage. Still, for lawmakers, the biggest question was money. How much money will the state ultimately be on the hook for when it comes to repairs? Maddox explained West Virginia will have to pay for 25% of the total damage, with reimbursement of up to 75% coming from two federal agencies, the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Federal Highways Program. Delegate Marty Gerhart questioned Maddox about those reimbursements.
In other words, bottom line, how much are we going to hit? Are we going to take in the state road fund?
About $12.5 to $15 million.
From flood-damaged roads to schools, the Legislative Joint Committee on Education was also updated on the cost of damage to public schools across the 12-county federal disaster area.
And we had a total of 33 facilities that were impacted or affected by the flood in 11 different counties. And that damage ranged from very minor to, of course, quite severe in a few cases.
That's Cindy Daniel, West Virginia's deputy superintendent. Daniel says public schools in the affected counties suffered $186 million in total damages. Two counties, Kanawha and Nicholas, had to close five schools combined. Those facilities will need to be replaced, but all of the affected students are in temporary classrooms at either previously closed schools or sharing space with students at other county facilities. Daniel says it will be up to the counties, the West Virginia School Building Authority, and FEMA to work together to fund replacement schools. Lawmakers are expected to be called into a special session in September to address associated recovery costs with the flood. That money will likely come from emergency accounts, including the state's rainy day fund. Small-scale farmers in the region often find it challenging to keep their land sustainable while staying competitive in the marketplace. Nicole Irwin visited a farm that's doing both with a method called rotational grazing. She found that this new approach grows from some very old ideas.
On 120 acres in Marion, Kentucky, a farmer is working to provide for a growing family of nine.
My name is Joseph Mass, and Joseph is good enough.
Joseph Mass belongs to an Amish community and is reluctant when it comes to media. He makes a concession, however, when the conversation involves sustainable farming practices.
Well, I'll always talk grass any day.
Mast is a grass farmer, using something called high-intensity grazing, strategically moving herds of livestock in sectioned-off portions of land. As we walk across his farm, we see cattle, sheep, chickens, and even hogs. It's a lot of work. Rotational grazing requires him to move his 20 cattle up to six times a day. Before Mass began this more intensive management style, he says he was actually working harder. He had to grow grain to feed his animals and earn additional income from medicine to treat livestock diseases. Since he began relying on his farm's grasses, he says his cattle and land healed themselves.
In that drought we had in 2012, a lot of people were feeding hay, never ran out of grass.
By moving the livestock strategically to prevent overgrazing, the grasses can grow tall enough to cover the surface, creating a moist environment for microorganisms that keep the ground rich in organic soil. That soil invites other healthy organisms, reducing dependence on medicine to treat things such as parasitic worms.
But I don't worm, period. That's harmful to the dung beetle.
The dung beetle is just one part of a process in fly and parasite control. Dung beetles dry up manure paddies left as breeding grounds for fly larvae and parasites. Dry up the dung, you dry up the larva. Introducing other animals to the pasture helps too.
So if the cow eats a parasite from the sheep, that's an end to that thing. So I can actually get more income from a farm by adding sheep and goats. So that would be a win-win deal there.
Like many small-scale farmers, Mass finds it tough to compete with larger farms. Rotational grazing proponents argue that this approach can help level the playing field.
The easiest dollar you'll ever make is the ones you don't spend.
That's Murray State University agriculture professor O.L. Robertson.
I happen to think that Mother Nature's a pretty smart old girl.
Robertson says sometimes before you can look forward, you have to look back. Back to those large herds of animals, such as bison, that used to run freely across the planet before the land was divided by ownership.
What we're doing with rotational grazing is trying to imitate that pattern. If you have a given area and you put a given number of animals on it, we want them to consume about 50% of it and urinate and defecate and trample the rest of it right down on top of the soil surface. That feeds the life that's in the soil.
Conventional farming argues against high-intensity grazing. How could large herds of animals do anything but trample the lush feeding grounds? Robertson hopes to fill this gap with his work.
Rotational grazing is not something that grabs the attention of university researchers. There's not a company that's really pushing this, that's willing to put research dollars into a university to obtain the data.
Robertson says he doesn't require herbicides and pesticides that can be offered by a company looking for product support. That's because the only thing needed to structure a rotational grazing pattern is some good polywire.
What we can do is we can take 100 acres, split it up into 10 paddocks, and we may need to even subdivide those paddocks, but we do that with one single strand of polywire.
Rotational grazing is viewed as labor intensive, but it's not, according to Robertson or Mast. It's intensive management, respecting the animals and the earth by working smarter, not harder. It might even be saving the planet. Joseph Mast agrees.
The benefits of your land, the response that your grass does, it pays off for it big time.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Nicole Irwin.
Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting.